You're listening to We Are SDS, a podcast from the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. Hi, everybody, and welcome to We Are SDS. I'm your host, Professor Joe Kane. This is episode 20. Hi, everybody, and welcome to We Are SDS. We haven't heard much history on the podcast lately, so today I'm handing the microphone over to Dan Sharp. Dan was a student in our integrated BSc program last year. That's a degree we operate with UCL Medical School to promote history and philosophy of medicine. Dan has a story to tell about Solly Zuckerman, a British scientist and government advisor from the 20th century. Hugely important in his day, Zuckerman is all but forgotten now. This episode is another in our series from the SDS Newsroom 2022. Here in SDS, we want to give students work experience in science communication. So each summer, we set up as many paid internships as we can, and we work with students to create content for publications like our annual magazine, SDS Alchemy. As part of their work, we also ask students to create a podcast episode. On any subject they choose, we want about 30 minutes, we want interviews, we want something SDS, but most of all, we want ideas and creativity. Dan's story starts with a seemingly crazy connection between Zuckerman and an oil spill in the 1960s. Let's see where he takes us. And I'll see you on the other side.
Did you know that in 1967, the British government bombed an oil tanker stranded on rocks off the coast of Cornwall? I certainly didn't. The catastrophe began on the 18th of March, 1967, when SS Torrey Canyon, then one of the largest oil tankers ever made, ran aground on Pollard's Rock, which lies between England's westernmost point, Land's End, and the Isles of Scilly. Carrying almost 120,000 tons of crude oil, it was the largest oil spill from a tanker at the time. The British government, led by Labour Prime Minister Harold Wilson, acted to minimise its impact. The first course of action was to use detergent on shore to try and clean Cornwall's tourist beaches. Surviving marine animals were cleaned by an army of volunteers. But after 2 weeks, with the spill not abating, the decision was taken to instruct the RAF to bomb the stricken tanker. The munitions included napalm, intending to set the remaining oil ablaze and to sink the tanker. This decision was informed by the government's first ever chief scientific advisor, Lord Solly Zuckerman. My name is Dan Sharp, and across the next 30 minutes or so, I will introduce you to Solly Zuckerman and attempt to answer the question, how did a scientific advisor reach a position where he influenced this decision? And how can science and technology studies students and researchers learn from incidents like this to understand how scientific advice influences political decision-making processes and other responses to events and catastrophes involving science? To learn about Solly Zuckerman, I first talked to Professor John Agar, a historian of science in the 20th century and co-head of the SDS department at UCL. So what should I know about Solly Zuckerman?
Well, he was a science advisor from the 20th century and probably one of the leading science advisors in the UK, and had a very interesting career that spanned pretty much the whole of the 20th century. So he was a South African, but he went to school in South Africa, and came to Britain and started off working at London Zoo, the Zoological Society of London, essentially as an anatomist. I mean, he's trained sort of basically in biology, medical science, and he was an expert on apes. He was essentially a primatologist, and that was his early work.
Zuckerman researched the zoo's flagship exhibit, Monkey Hill, a colony of Hamadryas baboons that predated him at the zoo. Against others' recommendations, the zoo had established a colony that contained both males and females. Zuckerman observed the violence of the male Hamadryas baboons at Monkey Hill and drew conclusions regarding the physiological basis of male domination in primate populations. These formed the basis of the thesis of his 1932 book, The Social Life of Monkeys and Apes. I spoke to Jonathan Burt, a historian and author who studies Zoe Zuckerman as part of his research on the history of London Zoo.
It's a kind of experiment by default, I think, which led to a series of scientific conclusions, which was The Social Life of Monkeys and Apes, which was the big text of primate and human social evolution, with conclusions that ran right through till, you know, primatology in the 60s began to revise it. And he never apologized, of course, famously for the theses in that book, even though a lot of field work began to show that it was inaccurate. Though, as a description of Hamadryas baboon society, it was accurate. It just, you couldn't just generalize from that species to primates generally.
I spoke to Elliot Honeybun on Order, a researcher at the University of Exeter, who looked at Zuckerman as part of his PhD thesis. He explained that the book shows the emergence of Zuckerman's interdisciplinary thinking, where he brought together strands of the sciences to answer a question.
So his work on monkeys and apes, I've been looking into that a bit for my thesis, and I think that is kind of, you can see an emergent kind of interdisciplinarity coming through that. He draws from a lot of different perspectives, biology, zoology, I think social anthropology. There's others, definitely. And he uses these kind of different perspectives to try and explain the kind of sociology of apes. And through that, he kind of paints a kind of deterministic picture that society of apes is governed by physiological factors, but also different kind of their kind of cultural stimulations and contexts and things. And although he is very cautious of projecting that onto humans, he says it's a lot more complicated than that. It is very kind of clear that his thinking about human society does stem from this broader interdisciplinary thinking of the apes that he had, and he kind of uses that for humans and thinks there's so many different things shaping societies, and science is one key variable that he believes can do a lot of good in quotations, whatever that means.
So Solly Zuckerman was a primatologist at the London Zoo who wrote a book about primate societies in the early 1930s. How did he then become one of the most influential scientific advisors? Elliot explained that Zuckerman did not spend all his time at the zoo.
He was involved in a kind of tight circle of preeminent scientists, but not just scientists. There was like two or three humanities people who then ended up becoming MPs for Labour. But that took me back there, where he was discussing the role of science in society in many forms, not just for war, not just for economics, not just for anything. It was just the role that science can play in helping society. And that, so that kind of came through this group that he had called Tots and Quats. But these kind of scientists were meeting over dinner. They were talking about the possible role that science can play in, you know, a period of post-World War I kind of depression, looming World War II, this kind of period where there was great kind of societal unease, not sure where things are going. But they were kind of rejoicing in the promise of science. Again, I'll say science in quotes because science is such a broad thing. They were kind of rejoicing in the possibilities that science can have in guiding social kind of planning.
Professor Agar explained that when World War II did hit, Zuckerman's first scientific role was more gruesome than joyous.
One of his early jobs in the Second World War was a very gory, gruesome job of essentially trying to understand scientifically the damage that bombs do to bodies. And the surrogate here was the bodies of animals that were essentially placed near explosives, and those explosives were blown up. And that was to try and understand how to protect people from bombing. So obviously during the Second World War, London and other parts of Britain were subjected to bombing raids from Germany, immense destruction of property and of life. And science was used to try and improve the defences, to improve how people were protected from those bombs. And that meant understanding what damage explosives did to bodies. So his understanding of anatomy was absolutely crucial there. And that was one of the first roles he had working for government. But very quickly, his abilities were picked up by senior people in the military and within government, because his advice was always very clear, very definite, sometimes challenging existing views. And that was seen to be particularly welcome in the urgency of the Second World War.
So Zuckerman was mobilised during the Second World War to provide scientific advice to the military. He soon weighed in, as John Agar said, on controversial topics.
Well, one of the most controversial issues during the Second World War was the effectiveness of bombing. So there were people who were saying you should bomb the centres of population, because that would undermine morale and that was the quickest way to victory. Other people, such as Zuckerman, said you had to bomb the infrastructure. So he was an articulate defender of a plan to essentially target the railway network, for example, that supplied the German army on the continent. And that meant bombing railway infrastructure across Germany and indeed into France as well, because obviously this is occupied France. And so he would be arguing that, but there were very fierce debate within military and government circles about what kind of bombing strategy to pursue, and Zuckerman was in the thick of that.
I asked Professor Agar whether Sawyer Zuckerman would have had a formal government role at this point in his career.
So, one of the trends you see in the Second World War is scientists working ever closely and at ever higher levels with military operations and military commanders. So Zuckerman, for example, worked very closely with Lord Mountbatten and with Lord Tedder. These are basically two essentially generals, offering advice based on their scientific calculations about how to pursue the war. And yes, so they would have had, these had official titles, essentially. They are scientific advisors to branches of the armed services. And so Zuckerman is recruited into the system, into mobilized as a scientist within this setup.
Was the Second World War the first British war where scientists had had that role within government?
It's not, no. The story is told that way, as if this was the very first moment that scientists had this role in government. But of course, it's not true. And for a long, long time, there's been experts and science at the heart of government. In the First World War, for example, scientists were mobilised to work on all kinds of things, such as the fight against the U-boats, for example. The design of naval ships has always been something that needed expertise, advising the Navy and the Admiralty. So, no, there's a long history of this, but there's no doubt that in the Second World War, we saw more of this, and to an extent at higher levels as well. it's that was one of the lessons that was learned, was having a scientific advisor very close to the highest levels of decision making was something that could make a real positive contribution. But at this stage, there was not a formal chief government scientific advisor, for example.
So Solly Zuckerman was brought into government during the Second World War to advise the military. After the break, we'll examine how he became government chief scientific advisor and his role in the Torrey Canyon catastrophe response.
What I like about SDS is the unique perspective it has provided me and the people it has allowed me to connect with who are on a similar or the same journey as me.
Let's get back to Dan's investigation of Solly Zuckerman and the Torrey Canyon disaster in 1967.
Welcome back. We pick up almost where we left off, with Zuckerman's career in the immediate post-war period.
So Zuckerman, I think by this stage, is very much part of the establishment, right? He's shown himself to be extremely useful and expert on many things in the conduct of the Second World War. He also marries the daughter of a marquis, which I don't think does any harm in terms of your social mobility. He returns, in a sense, to academia. He gets a position at the University of Birmingham as a professor, for example. But he does continue this relationship with politicians. So he's one of a number of people, scientists around government, who play an important role, offering advice, offering their expertise on various things.
But before taking up the position of government chief scientific advisor, Zuckerman held another Ministry of Defence position as their departmental chief scientific advisor. He offered advice on matters of state, such as potential nuclear disarmament, and scientific matters relating to the ongoing Cold War. In 1964, Harold Wilson became Prime Minister for the first time, leading a Labour Party administration whose election manifesto placed science and technology at the heart of its mission.
Wilson's very taken by Zuckerman. He thinks he's a very impressive individual, very competent. And actually what Wilson would like to do is appoint Zuckerman to be a Minister of State, to bring him right into government, which you could do. You can make him a Lord and you can make him a Minister. But this was going to be a sort of role that was going to advise on aspects of nuclear disarmament, for example, if that had to be managed. Or changes in the military in defence, but he a couple of reasons he didn't particularly get on with Dennis Healey, who was the Labour Minister of Defence, and that made his role as both sort of chief scientific advisor and possible minister in this area, a junior minister, basically untenable. But Wilson wanted to have Zuckerman's advice. So that's the reason why the position of government chief scientific advisor was created for Zuckerman to take up. And it is a system that has survived right to the present. But essentially you have in one person someone who will channel scientific advice to the very highest reaches of government, so in particular to the Prime Minister, someone who's responsible for organising and overseeing science policy making within government, someone who's responsible for, in a sense, actually as the chief executive of the scientific side of government.
So there we have it. Solly Zuckerman rose to the position as chief scientific advisor as a trusted official to the Prime Minister Harold Wilson. His time in the role lasted only until 1971, although he offered his advice to governments when requested well into Thatcher's tenure in the 1980s. But why is he interesting as a figure for SDS scholars? One reason brings us back to the SS Torrey Canyon.
One of Zuckerman's key moments as a chief scientific advisor was responding to a catastrophe, an environmental catastrophe. And that was the Torrey Canyon disaster of 1967, which was the first big, large-scale release of oil from a oil tanker, a big oil slick that was released when a ship ran aground off Cornwall. And so this is a catastrophe on many levels. This was an environmental catastrophe. So you have many, many seabirds being killed. It's an economic catastrophe because you've got oil washing up on the tourist beaches of Cornwall and northern France. And it's also a catastrophe in the sense that it happens very quickly. So someone like Zuckerman has to come in and offer his advice very quickly about what should be done. In STS, I would say we learn from episodes like that, because actually what's interesting about this episode is Zuckerman maybe did not make the right choices, right? So, or at least there were choices to be made and he leapt one way rather than another. He used detergent to try and break up the spill because they decided that even though that might kill more sea life, it might save the beaches and therefore the tourist income. He reverts to his old expertise, which is about directing bombing. In the end, they decide to bomb this gigantic oil ship, which is stranded on rocks off Cornwall, to try and break it up and sink it and take the oil to the bottom. Again, not necessarily the right choice. But what's interesting is how do you make decisions quickly in the face of a catastrophe? How do you use science in that process? How do you decide whether decisions were good ones or bad ones? Can you learn from it? So there's episodes in Zuckerman's life which are ideal case studies to look at from a STS point of view, where we are interested in that whole mix of science, technology, environment, communication, policy making, the attitude of the public, all wrapped up in it all in this episode.
As Professor John Agar just outlined, SDS scholars can analyse the decisions made by Solly Zuckerman in the face of catastrophes as a case study for how science advice is given. One source of material for Solly Zuckerman is his personal archive at the University of East Anglia. Elliot Honeybun-Arnolder described the experience of using this resource.
So it's fascinating. He must have... While looking through it, there's so many stories that could be told. There's so many different careers he's kind of had. There's so many kind of fingers in pies that he's had. It was quite overwhelming at first, but it was just remarkable at some point. I don't understand generally whether he knew he was so eminent and he kept all of this stuff, or whether he just kept all of this stuff generally and then it was deposited into the archive, because it is a very well-stocked archive.
And as Elliot's own research demonstrates, we can learn from other aspects of Zuckerman's career as chief scientific advisor too. In his role of chief scientific advisor, Solly Zuckerman and related civil servants were permitted to make sweeping changes to scientific higher education structures in the United Kingdom. This included the creation of the University of East Anglia with an environmental sciences programme. This sought to provide a new generation of scientists with a broad basis of skills for future challenges, both known and unforeseen.
It's important to reflect on, this was just an idea that Zuckerman had that then, through a load of range of other factors, became massively successful. It could have not worked out, but this was an idea that he thought, UEA would be a good place to trial this out and possibly create loads of graduates to create a new workforce in the future that is able and knowledgeable to deal with these challenges through the use of an interdisciplinary science.
I asked Elliot why he was a historian of science and what he thought we gained from looking back.
I think we can learn a lot about how new ideas and new visions of things come about. And I think the way in which the structures of knowledge and the institutions that we make knowledge in today, and the whole kind of higher education system and the scientific advice system in government and everything like that now, I think is not helpful to creating these new ways out of the challenges that we're in now. So looking back at the kind of freedom that Zuckerman had, rightly or wrongly, in these positions of power, whether it was democratic or not, whatever it was, that was novel in itself. And maybe we can learn from these kind of conditions that he was working in, you know, the people he was speaking to. And the same with the universities, the kind of context that they emerged in, they were given kind of relatively free rein to pursue new courses. I imagine that now, that wouldn't happen. So history and geography of science, I think, can show us times where it worked, where it didn't work. Not necessarily be prescriptive, but it can help us inform the new imaginations of the future, I think. But also it can sometimes show us, you know, things aren't as new as they seem. Because this interdisciplinarity kind of came out as like a buzzword, but really they were looking back to returning to the kind of breadth of natural philosophy as a way of making knowledge, which was just all-encompassing things to do with the world. And that's interesting in itself as well. So it's all these kind of different cycles, these different structures and how knowledge evolves, I think, is where history and geography of science, knowledge, can help.
The life of Solly Zuckerman, a historical scientific figure who pioneered an approach of science policy advice to government and wrote books for a broader audience reflecting on those experiences, provides so much material for SDS scholars to dig into. And as Elliot Honeyburn-Arnolder, Jonathan Burt and John Agar have demonstrated, their conclusions are relevant today. There is still so much even about this single man we do not know. As Elliot said to me,
If someone was interested to check that out, I think the social life of Solly Zuckerman would be a very interesting research topic.
Ooh, I like it, I like it! A story that's just the tip of an iceberg. Well done, Dan. Solly Zuckerman is a huge character in the history of science. He's also so important for defining what science policy and science advice to government is in the late 20th century as we move into the 21st century. History talks about the present. So if you know someone who might like to study with us, ask them to get in touch. Maybe it's to explore stories like this one. Or maybe it's about science policymaking, or philosophy of science, or science communication. They all fit under the umbrella of Science and Technology Studies, or STS. We love our work, and we're a thriving community too, so come along. Music today included two pieces, Roland at 5 and Écossaise in E-flat 86, both by Kevin MacLeod. They're available online at the website filmmusic.io. And in the break, you also heard Andrea Lecare, one of our undergraduates. We Are SDS is a production of the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. If you want to find out more about the show, listen to past episodes, or give us some feedback, visit us online. Here's the address, so write this down. It's ucl.ac.uk/STS/podcast. That's it for today. Thanks for coming along. We'll have another episode ready soon. Until then, Just remember, there's knowledge to be found just about everywhere, and that together, we are STS. Bye now. You've been listening to We Are STS, a podcast from the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. Subscribe to the show and join us online. The address, ucl.ac.uk/STS/podcast.